Today on Against the Grain, the U.S.-Mexico border is often in the news. But what's usually missing is the cost of the border itself, both in human terms and in terms of the political economy of the region itself. The deep entanglement of the livelihoods of people who live in places like Douglas, Arizona, with the border industrial complex. I'm Sasha Lilly, scholar Aaron Bobrow-Strain joins me to discuss the militarization of the border and its connection to deindustrialization and economic abandonment. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Why is it that since the early 1990s, well over $2 billion have been spent on immigration control? That's more than the DEA, FBI, U.S. Marshals, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and the Secret Service put together. What are the stakes, both political and economic? And how does it tie ordinary people who live there into the economy of the militarized border? In The Death and Life of Aida Hernandez, A Border Story, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, Aaron Bobrow-Strain explores these questions through the life of a young undocumented woman. He's professor of politics at Whitman College. Aaron, let's start with the story of the woman you call Aida Hernandez and with whom you collaborated on this oral history. Where did she grow up?
So, the book came out of a collaboration with this woman. We worked together for about 5 years to put together the story. I can say that she grows up undocumented on the Arizona border town of Douglas during the 1990s, right as the new Clinton-era border enforcement strategy that's really the genesis of the militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border and the pain and suffering that we've been seeing very intensely in the past few years really emerges out of that moment in the mid-1990s, and it comes crashing down on the town of Douglas, Arizona, where she's growing up. So she's growing up undocumented at the center of the national immigration storm in many ways.
Well, tell us about this location, this border town, Douglas, Arizona, and Agua Prieta on the other side of the border on the Mexican side. They are so central to Aida's story in your telling of it. Tell us about the history of these border towns, which change in the 1990s with national policies.
I went to the border in the early 1990s to work for an organization called Border Links on the Arizona-Sonora border. So I spent a bunch of time in Douglas and Agua Prieta at that time when Aida was growing up, although, of course, we didn't know each other and the story wasn't an inkling in my mind. During that time, it was a very formative time for me, that time on the border. And although the border has seen its share of hate and violence, it's a really rich and generative place. I really fell in love with the creativity of living one's life across borders, the kind of resilience that comes from living life between culture and language and international divides. And so when I started thinking about writing a book about the human toll of immigration and border policy, I knew I wanted to end up in Douglas and also Agua Prieta across the border from it. Unlike the way border cities are often portrayed in the media today, you know, they're actually very lovely, welcoming, beautiful communities with, relatively low crime. And with fascinating histories that really transcend their place on the international divide. So what drew me to Douglas and Agua Prieta was their place at the center of this immigration storm. But in the end, what actually kept me there, especially with Douglas, was I really started to get interested in the way that despite what seems like this exotic, unique border context, Douglas's story is really a larger American story about deindustrialization and loss. For most of its history, Douglas had been home to, or for much of its history, Douglas had been home to a relatively prosperous, upwardly mobile Mexican-American working class who had jobs in the copper industry. It was a town that had a real sense of its place at the heart of a global copper industry. There was a sense that, you know, kids growing up there, their parents worked at the smelter, they could either have union jobs in the smelter and a future, they could use the wages to go off to college. And then in the 1980s, 1987 to be specific, that all comes crashing down with a kind of typical story of Reagan-era anti-union economic restructuring. And almost overnight, Douglas is left without the kind of the economic core and the you know, the company and the industry and the manufacturing jobs that had once given it a sense of a place in the world. So it's a real, you know, broader American story about deindustrialization and loss. So the book is really about how those two things come together. On one hand, you know, we see this increasing militarization and hardening and the border becoming more punitive. On the other hand, we see deindustrialization. And I think that the book brings that together to remind us that, you know, we can't separate what's happening on the border from the larger U.S. story of kind of targeting communities of color for intensified policing and incarceration and prosecution. You know, I think that one of the lessons I learned in Douglas is that, you know, stories about white working class decline often, you know, receive hand-wringing and elegies and calls for solutions. But in a community of color like Douglas, Arizona, deindustrialization has brought intensified policing.
Well, explain that or expand on that more. So what did that look like on the ground in Douglas after the anti-union restructuring that took place in the 80s, the closing of the copper industry there, then what kind of economy did Douglas have?
Yeah, for quite a while, there was a sense of, there was a question mark. You know, what was Douglas's economy going to be? There was hopes as NAFTA came onto the into the picture that Douglas and would be sustained by cross-border trade, although it's a pretty remote town, over 100 miles from Tucson, kind of in the southeast corner of Arizona. It's not a great commercial hub necessarily. So cross-border commerce is very important, but it never became the engine of growth that it was hoped to be. There's still hopes that it could be. And a better version of border security would actually focus on building up cross-border trade in a positive way. So there's a big question mark, and many people left Douglas during this time. It was you know, a lot like a town in Iowa or Wisconsin that's lost the cannery or the washing machine factory that once sustained it. People were heading out. Stores were shuttered. A lot of stores were kind of in an indeterminate state of openness. A new Border Patrol strategy comes along in the early 1990s. It's a strategy that eventually gets called prevention through deterrence. And it emerges in the early 90s. Bill Clinton was its big champion. And the idea was in many ways to take a page out of the Republicans' Tough on Crime book by cracking down on the border. And I actually remember my very first glimpse of this strategy as it was just rolling out. I was in visiting El Paso in the fall of 1993, and the Border Patrol sector chief for El Paso had just done this thing that had everyone scratching their head. It was completely unprecedented. No one knew what to make of it. But what he had done was he had taken all of his Border Patrol agents off of their mobile patrols out in the countryside, and then instead just lined them up one after another, sitting in their trucks, not moving, along just the most populous urban stretch of the border. And people were like, what is this? What's going on? And the idea, Reyes, the chief, calculated was that if we can completely close down the urban sectors of the border, where it's easiest to cross, where people can disappear into the city, where they can get quick transportation to the interior of the United States, what we'll do is we'll end up forcing people out into the more rugged, difficult terrain outside of the city, and that will make border crossing more costly and more difficult. And as a result, he thought naively, fewer people will cross the border. So the strategy is prevention through deterrence. And I remember talking to Border Patrol agents that fall in El Paso, and they were so bored. You know, many of them had gotten into the job because they were, you know, addicted to they were excited by the thrill of the chase. And now they were just sitting on their X's, as it was called, doing nothing. Except, you know, stopping people from even attempting to cross in that urban stretch. But the strategy worked, or half of it did. The half of it that worked is that, yes, they shut down the urban border crossing. Apprehensions of undocumented border crossers fell dramatically overnight, and people were shunted out, funneled out into the rougher terrain outside of the city, where crossing was more difficult. Almost overnight, we see the price of migrant smugglers skyrocketing, and we start to see a steady increase in the number of people dying in the deserts as they attempt to cross, right? And that continues into the present moment, where we see thousands of people have died crossing the border. And the reason for that is because this strategy was deemed so successful, right? Because it appears to have shut down migration. It appears to have made migration more difficult. And so it gets taken up in other parts of California. It gets taken up in other parts of Texas. And as a result, what it does is it creates this giant funnel effect that steers a whole continent's worth of immigration into the hot deserts of Arizona. And that actually made cold political sense in a lot of ways, because Arizona had the deadliest terrain along the border. And if your idea was to deter migration by forcing people into deadly terrain, Arizona was the place to do it. Also, Arizona had fewer electoral college votes than California or Texas, so less power to complain about the fact that a massive funnel effect had just forced a continent's worth of migration into their communities, which was, you know, overwhelming small towns like Douglas, where, and Douglas, Arizona, was one of the first place this funnel effect hit. And it's a policy really of, we should say this loud and clearly, it's a policy of intentional cruelty, right? It's a bipartisan commitment that has run for 25 years as our dominant approach to border security. And the idea is that we make border crossing more deadly and more costly in order to deter migrants. In fact, some of the early policy documents from the 1990s that lay out this new strategy actually indicate that increasing deaths and increasing violence would be a sign of the strategy's success.
So from the time when this policy, prevention through deterrence, was enacted to now, what have been the levels, and they have changed, of migration across the U.S.-Mexico border?
Right. So the big logical question is, did this policy of deterrence through cruelty actually deter migration? And we know in retrospect that it really didn't. In fact, it moved migration around the border. It's a little tricky to parse this out, because we have seen that the number of people attempting to cross the border without authorization has fallen steadily since about 2000, 2001, and we're now down to record historic lows of people attempting to cross the border. So in that sense, it looks like deterrence has worked. But when scholars have actually gone and talked to migrants about their reasons for trying to cross the border or trying to not cross the border, it turns out that deterrence had a relatively minimal effect. Even, you know, cruel policies like putting people out into the desert, weaponizing the desert to literally kill people as a way to deter migrants, things like lateral deportation was a cruel strategy the Border Patrol devised, which took small groups of migrants, families, and instead of deporting them to capturing them, and instead of deporting them together back to a border city, it would take one member of the family and deport it to one border city, and deport another member of the family to another border city 1,000 miles away. So the Border Patrol increased the level of cruelty to achieve this deterrent effect, and it didn't work. And it particularly didn't work. The research shows, the interviews with thousands of migrants shows that it particularly didn't work when migrants were fleeing violence or had strong family ties in the United States. Those folks were going to continue to try to cross the border, continue to attempt this perilous journey, no matter what cruel obstacles the Border Patrol put in their way.
So, Aaron, in describing the transformation of the border, especially with the adoption of the policy of prevention through deterrence, which in fact is to make migration into the United States so much more deadly, it obviously changed not just the societies on both sides of the border, but also the economies of a place like Douglas, Arizona. You mentioned that with prevention through deterrence, organized crime, those smugglers, proliferated. Can you describe that part of how the economy of Douglas changed, and then more broadly for people who worked in the above ground economy, how were their lives changed economically by these new militarized deadly policies?
A controversial statement here would be that in many ways Douglas has become a border security company town, or maybe better put as it has become a border security and insecurity company town, in the sense that, you know, after the smelter closed and the good jobs went away and the air cleared, there wasn't a great source of employment in the town until this militarization hit. And it's steadily become one of the most heavily policed small towns in the United States. The last time I checked, about 1 in 7 men who are employed in Douglas are employed by law enforcement. So it's created a very and this is something I really wanted to get into with this book, because we've had a series of great books that tell us the story of migrants who are trying to cross the border, passing through the border. But I was really interested in, what about the community that's there on the border? What happens when their whole world gets turned upside down by policies that are created far from the border, that often have very little connection with the actual reality of migration or the border? And looking at the way, what happens when a town becomes a kind of border security and insecurity company town is central to the project. And it sets up some really powerful and painful moments in the book. For example, there's a moment in the book when a family member of Ida, who is a citizen, a U.S. citizen, and works for Homeland Security in a capacity, he's struggling to decide whether he should turn her in or not. So this kind of the coming of prevention through deterrence to the border drove all kinds of economic and social wedges and in between families and the community, and then also, of course, between Douglas and Agua Prieta. For many decades, Agua Prieta and Douglas were so close, so integrated. I talk about stories that baby boomers told me of, in the 1960s, where kids' baseball games, the outfield was in Mexico and the infield was in the United States, or people would slip through the little ratty wire fence to go get their hair cut in Mexico, and people would slip through the wire fence to go visit family in the United States. And it was, and some activists today in the town referred to it as Dogla Prieta. Instead of Douglas and Agua Prieta, they call it Dogla Prieta to emphasize that it's really one community. So it's a painful moment where the new economic engine for the town, security and insecurity, is also driving a wedge between these two intimately connected towns and the families and communities that span the geopolitical border.
And although the smugglers are not the main focus here of your book. How did that and also the drug trade affect the economies of Douglas, Arizona, Agua Prieta, Mexico?
Yeah, it's immeasurable, the effect, but it's large, and in many ways it puts a dampening effect on other kinds of economic development. But I think the thing that really struck me most about the role of cartels and organized crime in this region, in this moment, is something that we're not hearing in the United States that we really need to think about carefully. And that is that we've been trained by movies like Sicario to think about drug cartels as, horrible enemies. But in fact, if you're thinking from the perspective of the U.S. strategy, which is prevention through deterrence, drug cartels that have gotten steadily involved in the business of human smuggling are our allies. We have enlisted them. We have outsourced the ugliest, most violent work of deterrence to them. Well, so first of all, to give the paint the historical picture, for many decades, smuggling on the border was more of a mom-and-pop type operation. But then prevention through deterrence achieved its goal of making border crossing much more expensive. The price of crossing the border between Douglas and Agua Prieta went from about $150 to as much as $1,300 in the space of a couple years as prevention through deterrence hit. So smuggling got more and more lucrative, so that attracted these organized, awful, violent criminal groups to try to take over the mom-and-pop operations. And so essentially our policy has made smuggling much more profitable for cartels. And then also, like, if the goal is to, think about that early strategy document that said that one of the signs of success of this new strategy would be increasing violence. Right, so we've got a program that's really designed to make border crossing more dangerous, and cartel organizations, by extorting, exploiting, robbing, raping, and otherwise harming migrants at the border, are in effect doing that work of deterrence for us. That's why I say we have to come to grips with the fact that our choices, our policies, have outsourced the ugly violence of deterrence to these groups.
Well, let's talk about another element of the militarized border and the political economy of that militarized border, which is to do with detentions of immigrants. Who runs them and what takes place in these facilities?
So there's a variety. There's around 300 immigration detention centers in the United States under the auspices of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and they take a variety of forms. There are the most famous, what we hear the most about, are the private for-profit immigration detention centers, like the Corrections Corporation of America detention center in Eloy, Arizona, where Ida ends up at a point in the book. There are also detention centers simply run by ICE, and then increasingly common are where ICE will make agreements with local jurisdictions to use county jails and other facilities like that to hold immigrants for ICE. So in terms of what happens in them, I think that there are a number of disingenuous things that surround the way our legal system frames immigration detention, starting with the fact that because immigration, being in the United States without documentations, is a civil, not criminal offense, standards of evidence and due process are lower in immigration proceedings, and also standards of care and restrictions governing immigration detention are less strict than they would be in immigration prison. And the fiction here is that immigration detention isn't prison, it isn't punishment, it's simply administrative confinement. But you know, anyone who is in immigration detention will tell you that it looks like prison, it feels like prison. Many of them, like Eloy, are run on a medium security prison detention, criminal prison model. So it's fairly brutal conditions, but I also want to stress and people are separated from their families. Subject to paying outrageous prices to commissaries to make a basic diet. They pay outrageous prices to money transfer companies to get money placed on their accounts so they can buy food in the prison. They pay enormous amounts of money to telecommunications companies so they can call their loved ones. These immigration detention centers are a great moneymaker for many different constituencies. But I also want to stress that one thing that I don't think we've seen as much in kind of present-day media coverage of immigration detention that I think is really important and comes alive in this book is that the ability of migrants in detention to wrestle dignity and agency and courage in the face of all those horrific conditions. A lot of the reporting I've read on immigration detention recently often paints migrants in detention as kind of passive victims of this horrible system. And it is a horrible system. It's a really interesting in the book. It's really in immigration detention where Ida, in collaboration with all of this incredible community of women who are also fighting for their place in the United States, they come together and she gets a kind of a voice and becomes a leader in some ways. One of my favorite parts of the book is a moment where she organizes or helps organize a protest against the fact that the company running the detention center is trying to cut their shampoo and toilet paper ration to force people to buy more of their toiletries from the commissary. So I think, and you can look at this beyond my book to think about hunger strikes being organized in detention centers around the country. There's a tremendous amount of courage and agency on the part of immigrants in detention that isn't making it into the public picture. And I think what's needed here is not so much pitying immigrants who are in detention, but fighting for justice for them.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Aaron Bob Rose-Strain. He's professor of politics at Whitman College, author of The Death and Life of Aida Hernandez, A Border Story, which was published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and you can find a link to that on againstthegrain.org. He's also the author of White Bread and Intimate Enemies, both of which I had the pleasure of talking with him about. For people who find themselves detained in immigrant detention, what sort of legal recourse do they have, if any, and what sort of legal support do they get?
Well, again, because immigration detention is not a criminal detention, and because immigration law is civil law, immigrants in detention don't have a right to a government-appointed attorney. In most cases, they have a right to an attorney, although there's a crucial scene in the book where Ida experiences a program called expedited removal, in which low-level law enforcement officers act as judge, jury, and executioner in streamlined speed deportation hearings that aren't before a judge, an actual judge, and where Ida, even though she's asking for a lawyer, demanding a lawyer, is refused access to an attorney. Counsel is very difficult to obtain, it has to be obtained privately. So you see in Eloy, for example, attorneys who work with the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Organization told me that about 85% of the folks detained in Eloy at any given moment do not have legal counsel. And so they're trying to navigate. And immigration attorneys told me over and over again as I was writing this book that after tax law, immigration law is the most complicated, confusing, and incomprehensible body of law in all of U.S. jurisprudence. So you have thousands of people on a daily basis trying to navigate that system of law on their own. And not surprisingly, studies find that immigrants who have legal counsel are anywhere from 5 to 7 or more percent more times likely to win their case, which is to say, another way of putting that is that every day we are deporting people who have a legal right to stay in the United States, but weren't able to prove that because they didn't have legal counsel.
You mentioned earlier that people will cross the border despite how deadly it has become if they are the recipients of violence in the country that they're coming from. And of course, that includes domestic violence. To what degree is that taken into account, domestic violence and other forms of violence, when someone undocumented crosses over to the United States and gets swept up in the immigrant detention and enforcement system?
It's interesting, and that it's one area of immigration and asylum law where I would argue that there has been some progress made. You know, in general, we've seen asylum tightening, becoming harder to get. You know, since the 1990s, we've been closing the front door on legal immigration for most migrants, people like Ida growing up undocumented, living her whole life practically in the United States. There was no route for her to become a legal immigrant, really. But in the area of domestic violence, there are some interesting and important things that have happened, and it's two parts. The first part is that there is a route to asylum based on a series of legal precedents. I believe they're called the ARCG cases, in which people who have experienced extreme domestic violence in another country, and the government of that country was not willing or able to intervene or prevent that kind of violence, that an asylum case can be made in the United States. And I've actually testified in a few of these cases, and they're very powerful and moving cases. And there has been some success in people gaining asylum under those grounds. Jeff Sessions, when he was Attorney General, tried to, by fiat, declare those no longer valid or no longer valid reason for asylum. I'm not an immigration attorney, so I'm not giving you the perfect technical terms there, but that's the basic gist. But my understanding is that some recent court ruling have brought it back onto the menu again. So I think that's important. And then the other thing is that within the United States, there is a recognition in the Violence Against Women Act that while there's no real evidence that immigrant communities experience domestic violence at a higher rate than any other community, undocumented status or insecure immigration status gives abusers a huge amount of power and control that they don't have in other scenarios. I work with the Walla Walla Immigrant Rights Coalition, and just this month, we have a case of a woman who is here in the United States. Her legal immigration status depends on this man who brought her here, and he became abusive, she says. Every time she would try to respond to that, he would say, if you call the police or if you leave, I'm going to call immigration and get you deported. And that kind of power also appears in a number of places in The Death and Life of Aida Hernandez, where abusers are able to use that power to coerce women into staying in violent situations often. In fact, just as an aside, you know, that's another way in which prevention through deterrence has weaponized awful things, right? We've weaponized sexual and domestic violence to make conditions worse for migrants. But so within the VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act, there is a route to for women or men who have been who are the victims of domestic violence by a U.S. citizen that they're married to, or a legal permanent resident in certain circumstances, they can win a green card, and that's partially that's the law recognizing that power that abusers have and a way to give women and men who are suffering domestic violence the ability to escape from that situation without risking, you know, getting turned in, getting deported.
But presumably to do that, you need legal support. And you were saying that much of the time the legal support is insufficient.
Yeah, oftentimes it's not. And especially, you know, in small rural communities like Eastern Washington, where I live, we have a fabulous immigration attorney, two fabulous immigration attorneys in town. They're overwhelmed. And in some ways, you know, we live in an immigration law desert. You know, in small rural towns, a lot of the immigration, the low cost pro bono immigration law support is in big cities. So if anyone is out there at the, you know, the University of California School of Law or listening to this and thinking about becoming an immigration attorney, think about going out to rural communities where there's a tremendous need for that kind of support.
Well, let's talk more about the militarization of the border and the people who benefit from it, because vast amounts of money are spent on every component of this militarized border, detaining people in immigration centers for crimes like shoplifting. Things that are mild warrant massive amounts of money being spent. So you've touched on some of the beneficiaries of this militarized border, including organized crime, obviously, the people who work in and run, especially the private prisons. But what else is there?
Yeah, it goes so far down into the pores of communities, and I think that's one of the things that makes it so hard to challenge. And just to kind of give a sense of what we're talking about here, since the prevention through deterrence rolled out in the early 1990s, we have spent about the inflation-adjusted equivalent of two Marshall plans for the reconstruction and rebuilding of Europe, chasing this illusion of deterrence on our immigration and border enforcement. So massive, massive quantities of money, well over $200 billion chasing this illusion. And we think of, you know, private prison companies as being one of the big, they're kind of in the media as one of the people who make money off of this trend. But it's also about the creation of massive federal bureaucracies that employ large numbers of people. In fact, the Customs and Border Protection, the organization that the Border Patrol is part of, is the largest police force in the United States. By 2012, the budget for immigration enforcement was at the federal level was greater than the combined budgets of the DEA, the ATF, the FBI, the Secret Service, and the U.S. Marshals Service, with several billion dollars in spare change left over. So we're talking about massive quantities of money chasing this illusion of deterrence. And it gets down, in a place like Douglas, it gets down to the pores of the community, right? So you've got a town council in a town that's, you know, struggling to make balance the budget, right? So it can get grants from Homeland Security. You've got local folks who realize that, you know, they finished high school and what are the good jobs out there? Well, Border Patrol or other federal agencies are, you know, among the best jobs you can get if you're a Mexican-American growing up in a place like Douglas often. There are the transportation companies that contract with the government to move detainees. There are the, I mentioned these already, but there are the, you know, the Western unions that transfer money to detention, to detainees' credit accounts in prison. There's the phone companies. So we've created this massive, deep border military industrial complex. And in a sense that, you know, when people say, oh, the border is broken, there's something wrong with our current policy. Actually, the border isn't broken. It's working more or less as intended, right? It was intended to create cruelty and violence and problems in the hope of deterring people. The deterrence isn't actually working, but it's working as intended. And as a kind of collateral benefit, it's providing this kind of massive political economy of people who are invested in and have a stake in not fixing problems on the border, but in the perpetual border crisis, right? The whole political economy depends on having an enemy that we can defend against in the course of a perpetual border crisis.
Aaron Barbaro Strain is my guest. He is the author of The Death and Life of Aida Hernandez, A Border Story. And I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, what you're describing and what you illuminate in the telling of the life of Aida Hernandez is astounding. The massive amount of resources that are spent in enforcing the border. And yet, we know that since the mid-2000s, the flow of migrants has dramatically fallen off. And although there are those who would say, well, that's because of the border enforcement working, there's a great deal of evidence that it has to do with other circumstances why people are wanting to cross over into the United States that are not to do with deterrence necessarily. And so putting Trump aside, and in some ways, unfortunately, it seems like a lot of the conversations around the border now get personified by the particular horribleness of Donald Trump, which is indisputable, that horribleness. But as you're showing, these are policies that long precede him. So why is it that so much money is spent on the border? What is the ultimate logic? I mean, you've mentioned that it's enormously profitable, but is this really about trying to keep people from crossing the border?
The reason I wrote this book and collaborated with Aida to tell this story is we wanted to write a book for people who really want to understand what's happening on the border and how we got there. In a really in-depth and nuanced and complex way. And we wanted that story to be able to come through in the form of a kind of a gripping emotional tale that reached people's hearts and minds. And so, you know, I invite people to think about this in complex ways. I think that just pointing to the profiteering of private prisons, you know, it's a piece of the puzzle. But it's a small part, right? So it's what we see on the border is a kind of a confluence of many different interests, many different people who have a stake in border crisis. So you've got, you know, white nationalists for whom the specter of chaos and violence on the border confirms their sense that, you know, brown and black migrants are scary, awful, terrible people. You've got politicians of all different stripes, Democrats and Republicans. This has been a bipartisan obsession with border security and deterrence for 25 years, who are able to launch themselves into public office by looking tough on the border. In fact, Sylvester Reyes, the Border Patrol chief who launched that the first kind of glimpse of prevention through deterrence in 1993, shortly after that, was able to launch himself into office as a representative from Texas. So you've got political stakes, you've got the United States' long history of nativism and racialized exclusion, and you've got profiteering. And then you've got the fact that we are not addressing fundamental inequalities within the United States. So I think Trump has been very good at working with and playing up the sense that someone else is getting a benefit that I'm not getting. And that's why I'm not as successful, or that's why I'm not in as good a position as I should be. Someone else is getting that benefit. And immigrants have been a great scapegoat to blame for that. But really, it's really a much larger story of economic inequality in the United States, that if we want to understand, you know, why some people are not doing as well as they feel like they should be doing. Again, it's just a complex confluence of forces, and part of the idea of telling the book with the tools of nonfiction, research, oral history, government documents, court documents, but using also the tools of narration and fiction is to allow people to get immersed in that story and be able to kind of think for themselves about all of those different threads that play into the border.
What about the component of the labor supply that comes into the United States? Because clearly there are places well beyond the border that are dependent on low-wage workers who tend to be undocumented. Would you say that in terms of the business class in the United States that they're divided over the question of the border, or does border policy keep the labor that does come in so cheap?
I was really inspired by the work of the anthropologist Gilberto Rosas, got me thinking about the ways in which, the border isn't a failed attempt at deterrence so much as it is a successful vulnerability machine. Which is to say that the border puts the kind of the militarized punitive border puts migrants through a process in which they are stripped often of, that attempts to strip them of dignity, of possessions, of resources. It often ends them up in serious debt that they have to pay coyotes to smuggle them due to the high increasing cost of migrant smuggling. So essentially what it does is it takes people who are kind of intrepid, entrepreneurial folks going off to, you know, make a better life for themselves, in some cases others, folks fleeing violence, of course, as well. But it turns them into a highly vulnerable, highly exploitable labor force.
Could there be a political opening at this point against the militarized border and the border industrial complex? Certainly in the last few years with Trump, although, of course, as you're arguing, these policies predate Trump, many of these policies. But given that, in a sense, his presidency has shined a light on the border and of organizing against ICE, but a lot of that has become very visible, and even political calls to abolish ICE, do you think there is a political opening right now to challenge the militarization of the border and the policies that are connected with it?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, I'm glad the Democrats have finally realized how harmful their obsession with so-called border security has been over these past two decades. And I think they really need to go further. You know, the Democrats' smart security proposal is really just a rewarmed version of the old deterrence model. And ultimately, we need to get beyond this militarized, enforcement-only deterrence model on the border. But where I see real hope is not in the political parties right now or the legislature. It's in the social movements that have really been launched into prominence by recent events, particularly groups led by immigrant youth, such as United We Dream and others that are, I would say, are really out there on the front lines, not just resisting these policies, but also forging the new vision of membership and belonging that the United States really needs.
Let me end by asking you, how do you think people can support the struggles of the undocumented and activists in opposing these policies, given that you're saying what's coming up from below is the most hopeful?
There's so many levels of work people can do. I mean, starting with not falling into the trap of seeing the border as kind of inherently this violent, dangerous place, right? Not falling into the Sicario movie trap, and instead trying to understand this, what's happening on the border, as the logical consequences of a set of policy choices we've adopted, really, that have been adopted. For those of us who are viewing the border from a kind of more comfortable remove, these policies have been adopted in our name, supposedly to make us safer. So really listening to voices from the borderlands who are telling us, hey, the border wasn't always like this. This is not what we want. We could have a different border. So listening to voices from the border and thinking about the visions of belonging they're crafting, listening to those immigrant youth-led organizations that are out in the forefronts of this right now, I think those are the first steps that people can be taking. And then starting to normalize talking about some fairly strong changes, right? If you listen to the story of prevention through deterrence that I've told, which is a story about intentionally deciding to make a violent, abusive system in the hope of creating deterrence, you know, for me, that says that this is not something that needs a fix. The Democrats have talked about, oh, we need to fix the system. It really needs to be abolished and built anew. So we'll need an immigration system that really begins to take into account the long and deep history of interconnection between the United States, Mexico, and Central America, and that takes into account the fact that folks like Aida Hernandez are living in U.S. communities, shaping U.S. communities, making U.S. communities fully, even if they're not legally members of those communities. And so my hope in the end is that as much as this book is an empathetic portrait of Aida, it will also be a look in the mirror for the rest of us, right? Folks who observe what's happening in the border and immigration policy from somewhat of a distance, because those policies have, the ones that have made her life so difficult and harrowing and almost unlivable, have been carried out in our name, supposedly to make us more secure.
Aaron Bobrow-Strain, it's been a pleasure having you back. Thank you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with the author of The Death and Life of Aida Hernandez, A Border Story. That's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And you can find it, a link to it, on againstthegrain.org. Aaron Bobrow-Strain is professor of politics at Whitman College and a founding member of the Walla Walla Immigrant Rights Coalition in Washington State. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.